Good afternoon. Today we celebrate John Cannon's appointment as the inaugural Blaine T. Phillips Distinguished Professor of Environmental Law. The main event of that celebration, of course, is a lecture by the chairholder. John has come down with a cold, but is determined, nevertheless, to soldier on. If by any chance his voice should give out at any point during the lecture, I will simply jump up and declare the reception underway. A quick word about the chair itself. Blaine Phillips, of the class of 1955, is the executive director of the Fair Play Foundation in Wilmington, Delaware, and is active in a remarkable array of philanthropic endeavors. He is also a very long-standing and loyal supporter of the law school. I might also note that his son, Blaine Phillips Jr., who is a vice president of the Conservation Fund, was for a time a lawyer here in Charlottesville at the Southern Environmental Law Center. Blaine endowed the chair in 1999. The search for a senior and distinguished professor of environmental law took some time, but no one could quibble with the result. The inaugural chairholder, John Cannon, took a delayed path to an academic career, having spent many years in the policy arena. After practicing environmental law, John joined the Environmental Protection Agency in 1992 as Assistant Administrator for Administration and Resources Management. In 1995, he became the EPA's General Counsel and served in that post until 1998 when he joined the law school faculty. That move was an experiment both for John and for the law school. John's initial task was to teach in and manage our environmental law and law program. In this, he was successful beyond our most hopeful expectations. During his time at the law school, John has taught the basic environmental law survey course together with a rich array of more specialized offerings that cover land use, environmental liability litigation, environmental ethics, climate change, and watershed management, among others. The number of offerings, number of students, and national profile of our environmental law program have all increased to a point where we can say proudly that environmental law is one of the law school's curricular strengths. But John also rapidly adapted to the academic culture. Although his appointment was not initially to a tenure-track position, he fully integrated himself into the intellectual life of the law school, embarked on a successful scholarly research agenda, and ultimately became a tenured member of our faculty. John's research, while firmly grounded in environmental law and policy, has a broader intellectual reach. A nice example is his 2006 article, Environmentalism and the Supreme Court, A Cultural Analysis. The article begins with the observation that the way we think and talk about environmentalism underwent a substantial shift over the course of the 20th century. Some of us, and I must say that John joins me in this category, are old enough to remember when what is today called environmentalism was called conservation. The term captured the importantly anthropocentric nature of the movement. It focused on stewarding resources today in order to have them to consume tomorrow. It therefore treated the environment as instrumental, as a means to satisfy human wants. Today's discourse, by contrast, is dominated by what John calls the new environmental paradigm, a set of ideas and beliefs in which humans are simply one part of a larger ecosystem and not physically or morally more important than the other parts. This shift in thinking about man's place in the environment, the shift from a hierarchical to a non-hierarchical relation, is reflected in the priorities of environmental advocacy groups and therefore in the types of litigation that come before the Supreme Court. It also, therefore, has the capacity to affect the way the court itself interprets the nature and purposes of environmental law. Not entirely surprisingly, John finds that the court to date has not embraced the implications of taking an ecocentric rather than an anthropocentric approach to environmental policy. But he argues that a dialectical process is underway in which the court will have to engage seriously the values asserted in modern environmental litigation. But while looking for connections between environmental law and policy and broader theoretical themes, John has never abandoned his careful and meticulous policy orientation. In his recent article, A Bargain for Clean Water, for example, John observes that failures to meet the water quality objectives set out in the Clean Water Act are in substantial measure a result of the Act's failure to regulate non-point sources, principally agricultural runoff. John observes that while Congress believed, or at least asserted, in 1992 that such sources could not be effectively regulated, it is only true that they cannot be effectively monitored. Regulatory devices other than command and control could make a substantial difference. John carefully surveys the policy tools available to EPA and suggests plausible ways of reducing pollution from agricultural sources. This thorough familiarity with the literature and institutions of environmental law and policy have made John not merely one of the Academy's most respected and most respected environmental law scholars, but an extraordinarily effective and popular teacher. If ever there were an area in which supply creates demand, it is in John's courses. This semester's environmental law class has an enrollment of 94, making it one of our largest elective courses. The attraction is not difficult to understand. John is as knowledgeable about the subject matter as anyone in the nation and brings a contagious enthusiasm to his classes, as he does to all the activities of the environmental law program. There could be no better choice for the Blaine T. Phillips Professorship in Environmental Law, and I'm delighted to welcome the inaugural chairholder, John Cameron.
Thank you, Paul. It makes it all sound so wonderful. And thanks to all of you for coming, and thanks to this community for welcoming Al's and me into its midst 12 years ago and being so supportive and challenging also in the 12 years that have passed. This is a wonderful institution. I appreciate it every day and am very grateful to be a part of it. So, cost-benefit analysis and the court. This is my topic. Cost-benefit analysis, which is a tool for making policy decisions, and the court, an institution that does not make policy decisions. So you are wondering, what's there to talk about? I hope to convince you that there is a topic here and that I have something useful to say about it. It's part, as Paul mentioned, it's part of a larger project that I'm still working on, which is to track the court's response to and effect on environmental thought and action in this country over the last five or six decades. For decades, cost-benefit analysis has been a lightning rod in social policy, in regulatory policy. The left hates it, the right loves it, deregulatory forces embrace it, environmentalists and others have real difficulty with it. There's some evidence that the battle lines are beginning to ease a little bit, but the debate certainly continues. And it's an important debate because it's a debate about the choices, ultimately, the choices that we make in environmental policy, where we set the line, if you will, for what we want to achieve in environmental policy and in these other areas of social regulation. And for me, at least, everything else in environmental policy is secondary to that. So that when Cass Sunstein celebrates the cost-benefit state, as he does, he is really celebrating efficiency as a touchstone of regulatory policy. My purpose here is not to take sides in this debate. Instead, it's to explore the court's role in determining the authority of federal agencies to use cost-benefit analysis in their regulatory decisions. And for me, the question has two related components. One is, what's the level of acceptance of cost-benefit analysis within the political culture? And two, what is the scope of the court's interpretive role? So this ends up being a talk about judicial interpretation. Probably not so surprising in a law school. I have to say, when I was working on this last weekend, I had a dream, not while I was working on it, but I was sleeping. I had a dream, and I dreamed that this week was going to be National Statutory Interpretation Week. Right? You think only a law teacher could have such a dream. But I did. I had that dream. So this talk seems to me be perfectly appropriate for this moment in the national consciousness. I know that's a little bootstrappy, but that's okay. So today in my talk, I'm going to focus on three Supreme Court cases that address agency authority to consider cost-benefit analysis. And I'm going to argue that there is a progression in those cases, culminating in a recent decision of the Supreme Court, a decision last term, Entergy Corporation versus Riverkeeper, Inc. In Entergy, the court upheld EPA's authority to use a weak form, and I'll explain that in a minute, a weak form of cost-benefit analysis in setting standards for electric utility plants. That case, in my view, suggests that a majority of the court is now inclined to put a thumb on the scale in favor of cost-benefit analysis to screen out irrational outcomes. That's where the statute is arguably silent or ambiguous on the issue. At the same time, the court suggested a reluctance to embrace a strong form of cost-benefit analysis with efficiency as its goal, and with a purpose of determining efficient outcomes. So that's my interpretive claim. Right? My normative claim is that's a good thing. A weak form of cost-benefit analysis of the sort that the court approved in Entergy is supported by a political consensus within this country that I hope to demonstrate to you. And therefore, it's appropriate that the court presumed in favor of it where the statute was arguably silent or ambiguous on the issue. At the same time, a strong form of cost-benefit analysis with efficiency as its goal does not enjoy such a consensus and therefore does not warrant a judicial presumption in its favor. So my argument here proceeds through five questions. One, what is cost-benefit analysis? What's the debate about it, at least in broad outlines? How does that debate get reflected in institutional practices of the executive branch and Congress, and we will see divergent practices there? What's the court's history in this debate? And going forward, what's the role of the court, if any, as arbiter of this difference of views? So cost-benefit analysis in its most developed form, or the strong form as I'll call it, is a creature of welfare economics. Right? It's commensuralist and it's welfarist, that is, it requires that costs and benefits be reduced to a common measure, money, for comparison purposes, and its function is to maximize overall well-being. There's a presumption against regulatory options whose costs exceed their benefits. Now, that presumption is irrebuttable for some proponents of cost-benefit analysis. Other proponents of cost-benefit analysis will acknowledge that efficiency goal is important, but it's not exclusive. There's room for other considerations, other non-welfarist considerations to be brought to bear. So a methodology to determine overall well-being seems like a good thing. What's all the problem with it? Well, part of the problem is historical. Cost-benefit analysis came to the fore or achieved its first major institutional recognition in the administration of Ronald Reagan, and it was used in that administration as a deregulatory tool to push back against government regulations. In part, a function of that history, the standard cost-benefit analysis methodology now includes a number of elements that are criticized as anti-regulatory, that is, biased against regulation. Progressives Ricky Revesz, dean at NYU Law School, and Michael Livermore argue that that methodology can and should be corrected in order to adjust for these biases, and if that's done, it could produce a reliable, neutral tool. So that's a set of methodological criticism, but there are also philosophical criticisms. In a vastly simplified form, and my apologies to all the philosophers in the room, the moral objections to cost-benefit analysis go something like this. First, critics claim that cost-benefit analysis is based on preference satisfaction, and therefore is not a good proxy for human well-being, which is what it's trying to get at. Our preferences, typically measured in willingness to pay, may not improve our welfare. They may be perverse, they may be ill-informed, or otherwise mistaken. Now, in a recent book, Matt Adler and Eric Posner offered a systematic defense of a preference-based approach to welfare. And I think that's quite successful defense. But their argument, if followed, would require a significantly different kind of cost-benefit analysis than is standard today. And their argument is still not accepted by a lot of the critics. Moreover, even assuming that cost-benefit analysis can approximate human well-being, welfare is not the only value. Right? There may be other moral values that are significant or relevant or argued for in these cases. And the critics of cost-benefit analysis say that the commensurability of cost-benefit analysis, its welfarist approach, crowd out these other values in a way that diminishes their importance. These are values like avoiding harm to other human beings or to the environment. The moral critics of cost-benefit analysis stop short, most of them, not all, stop short of saying that we must protect the environment or health and safety, whatever the cost. Instead, their argument is cost-benefit analysis systematically devalues these environmental health and safety concerns. Proponents of the methodology argue, well, maybe it's not a perfect methodology, but it's much more likely to produce welfare-enhancing results than procedures that maximize along one dimension of human well-being, like breathing clean air, or that favor non-welfarist rights over welfarist considerations, like protection of species. So they argue that while overall welfare may not be the only measure of the right or the good, it's certainly an important measure. We don't want to end up causing more deaths from loss of income than we save from cleaning up the air. This is what John Graham calls statistical murder, just to put a point on it. Now, perhaps I'm just an optimist, but I think there's room in this debate for coalescence over a period of time. But in the meantime, this debate complicates efforts to reconcile divergent practices of the executive branch and the legislative branch, as I will describe in just a moment. Cass Sunstein has envisioned this idea of a cost-benefit state where everybody happily dwells with their welfare maximized, but that cost-benefit state does not currently enjoy a political consensus. And I think probably Cass Sunstein would agree with that on a good day. Now, by contrast to strong cost-benefit analysis of that, as discussed, and the criticism of it. The weak form of cost-benefit analysis is much less subject to these criticisms. It doesn't involve reducing everything to a single monetary unit, right? And its goal is not to establish some point of efficient determination or even some narrow range. Its purpose is just to weed out obviously or grossly irrational or disproportionate outcomes. So it avoids a number of the criticisms that I've mentioned as crucial to the strong form of cost-benefit analysis, and this will become important as we go. So how do these competing views of cost-benefit analysis reflect themselves in institutional practice? We're sort of going to come down out of the clouds now and see how actual institutions reflect this divergence of ideas and thoughts about cost-benefit analysis. And I'm going to focus here mostly on the two political branches, the executive branch and Congress. In authorizing legislation, Congress, the practice is mixed. There is no organic statute for the Environmental Protection Agency. So you've got statutes enacted at different times, in different contexts, a real scattering of provisions, if you will. And you see within that scattering of provisions a real diversity of congressional views about the validity or merits of cost-benefit analysis. In these provisions, Congress sometimes expressly provides for cost-benefit analysis, sometimes expressly excludes it, and more often probably is arguably silent or ambiguous on the issue. An example of this last category, a standard that requires protection against environmental harms to the extent feasible. Well, what does feasible mean? You can just see Justice Scalia working with the word. Among 10 major environmental regulatory statutes enacted in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s, two expressly authorized a balancing of costs and benefits in their core regulatory provisions. The remainder relied mainly on harm-based or technology-based approaches that either expressly excluded cost-benefit analysis or did not expressly provide for it. More recently, in 1996, the last year in which Congress revised major environmental legislation, Congress split. It expressly authorized the consideration of cost-benefit analysis in setting drinking water standards and expressly excluded it in setting pesticide standards. So, you have a real mixture here. In contrast to this mixed history in Congress, since the early 1980s, the executive branch, particularly the White House and the Office of Management and Budget, have consistently, in both Democratic and Republican administration, required cost-benefit analysis for all significant rulemakings. Also, where the law permits, federal agencies are required to adopt only regulations whose benefits justify their costs. And these requirements are enshrined and are still enshrined in Executive Order 12866, to which I will refer as we go. Now, some agencies like EPA have heroically resisted cost-benefit analysis. This is different in different administrations, but typically the agencies, EPA included, are more reluctant to embrace cost-benefit analysis than OMB for the reasons I've already talked about. They think it undermines their mission to protect the environment, worker health, safety, and so forth. This has led to conflicts with OMB, constant arguments about the need for cost-benefit analysis and the content of those studies. And again, Cass Sunstein, who pays careful attention to these things, has done a study which shows, not surprisingly, that agency implementation of Executive Order 12866 is very uneven. I mean, some agencies just don't pay very much attention to it or try their best not to. Now, in the Obama administration, this conflict has reached a new level of visibility for the reason that Cass Sunstein, now known to you as a primary advocate of the cost-benefit state, is head of the OMB Regulatory Review Office. So his job is to force agencies to do cost-benefit analysis, to do them well, and to consider their results in making their decisions. Lisa Heinzerling, formerly a professor at Georgetown University Law School, is or has been appointed as the policy chief at EPA. Her job is to get EPA rules through OMB with a minimum of interference. Now, to make this even more amusing, Lisa Heinzerling is a former student, law student, of Cass Sunstein's. A very good student, one of his best, he says. So, we all wish that our students will thrive, but perhaps not to the extent of becoming our major antagonists in life. Anyway, let me make clear here. There's no direct conflict between Congress and the executive branch here. Executive Order 12866 only requires agencies to consider cost-benefit analysis if they're permitted to under law. But there is a clear tension between the robust embrace of this methodology by the executive branch and the ambivalent or uneven approach to it that we see in the legislative branch. And this tension has a clear temporal dimension. Most key environmental statutes were adopted before, that is in the 60s and 70s, before the enthusiastic embrace of cost-benefit analysis by the executive branch. So I can now reframe the question with which I began. What, if anything, should the Supreme Court be doing to address this tension in interpreting the authority of agencies to engage in cost-benefit analysis? Now, there are at least three possibilities, conceptual possibilities, that I can identify here. One is that in cases where the statute is silent or ambiguous or otherwise not clear, the court could adopt a posture of scrupulous neutrality. That is, it could call them straight up. And where the statute made some clear indication of preference one way or the other, also call it straight up. No thumb on the scale in either direction. And I'm going to argue that TVA v. Hill, which I will discuss, is a case that adopts just such a position of neutrality. Right? Second, a court could adopt presumptions favoring consideration of cost-benefit analysis. Cass Sunstein argues that there should be a mandatory presumption requiring agencies to use cost-benefit analysis where the statute is silent or ambiguous on the issue. That is, agencies would be pushed in those statutory situations of uncertainty to adopt this procedure. A permissive version of this presumption would make room for consideration of cost-benefit analysis at the agency's option, but without requiring it. And we'll see this presumption at work in Entergy, or so I will argue. Third, a court could adopt comparable presumptions disfavoring cost-benefit analysis, that is, going in the other direction. And we'll see an example of this in American Textiles, a case that I'll also discuss. But first, before we get to the cases, a note on presumptions in interpreting statutes that grant agency authority to do things like issue regulations. A lot of the interpretive work on questions of agency authority will necessarily be done by Chevron versus NRDC, the decision 1984 by the Supreme Court. That decision, in its most basic form, establishes a presumption in favor of agency interpretations of their own authority, including their authority to do or not do cost-benefit analysis. Under Chevron, where Congress has not spoken directly to an issue, the court is to defer to an agency's reasonable interpretation. Within the Chevron framework, however, and this is key to my argument here, there remains room for a cost-benefit presumption of the sort that I have described to do work. In the most extreme case, a mandatory presumption, pro or con, could foreclose agency interpretive options, even in cases of silence or ambiguity. More modestly, a permissive presumption could operate to expand or contract the space within which the agency would be given discretion to make its own interpretation. Presumptions of this sort don't need to be in the form of formal rules. They don't even need to be explicit. They can be in the form or in the nature of background norms that influence judges in their understanding of text. Whether statutes are silent or ambiguous is to some degree in the eye of the beholder. And presumptions of the sort that I've described can influence how a judge will call that question in a particular case. All right, so that's prologue. Let's go to the cases. And we will see how the court has tried each of these different possible presumptions on this issue in the past, and then we'll bring that to the present. First, the studiously impartial. Right? This is where the court just calls it like it is. And my example here is TVA v. Hill, the famous snail darter case, right? All of you have heard about this case. Some of you have studied it. Some of you have probably written about it. This case was decided in 1978 before cost-benefit analysis assumed its present status within the executive branch and also before Chevron, which may be relevant. And in this case, the court famously interpreted Section 7 of the Endangered Species Act as precluding the completion and operation of the Tellico Dam in the Tennessee River Valley. The dam was more than 80% complete. It had more than $50 million invested in it. All that was left, basically, was to close the gates and let the dam fill up. The snail darter, which was the reason for the court's determination that the dam could not go forward, was a listed endangered species whose habitat happened to include the area that was going to be flooded by the dam. Right. So a majority of the court held that Section 7 imposed an absolute prohibition on any federal action that jeopardized a listed species like the snail darter. This is the court talking. The Endangered Species Act does not authorize a fine utilitarian calculation, or apparently a gross utilitarian calculation, right? Now, there is no judicial presumption against cost-benefit analysis working in this case. Indeed, if you read the case carefully, which I have tried to do, you find that the sympathies of the court, and you can find textual evidence for that, are really with the dam builder, not with the little snail darter, right? Chief Justice Berger's opinion for the court makes pretty clear the view that stopping the dam to save an obscure species of no known economic value doesn't make common sense. Right? So along with the holding here, there was a message to Congress: don't expect us to pull your chestnuts out of the fire. So this is a classic preference eliciting, if you frame it, put it like scholars would, right? Preference eliciting outcome rather than a preference estimating outcome. Now, the denouement here was interesting. Congress took this opinion. It changed, it amended the Endangered Species Act to provide for a cabinet-level review team, the so-called God Squad, which it authorized to make a determination about whether the benefits of a proposed federal action clearly outweighed the benefits of actions to protect the species. If so, the project could go forward even if it jeopardized the species. So a limited cost-benefit analysis was provided for. But here, the God Squad met, And it found that the costs of going forward with the dam were not justified by the benefits, right? It was just a bad project. But it was approved anyway by Congress through an appropriations rider. Of course! I mean, this is a dam, right? It's got to be approved. Right? So, rather than putting the burden on Congress to adjust the outcome, which is what the court did here, basically, here, the court could have followed a different tack. And this tack is laid out by Justice Powell in his dissent in this case. He argued that Congress should be presumed not to have intended an absurd result, and that this was tantamount, this sacrificing the dam for the species was tantamount to an absurd result. And he worked to find room in the statute. He started with a very strong presumption in favor of weighing costs and benefits to protect against just this kind of outcome. He created room, found ambiguity in the statute, in the word action, in order to try to express this very strong presumption, and then construed the term to avoid the absurd outcome. Now, he didn't carry the day in that case, but Powell's opinion, in my view, lays the doctrinal groundwork favoring some kind of cost-benefit analysis that we will see used by Justice Breyer and Justice Scalia in Entergy. So, our next case, American Textile Manufacturers Institute. There, the court arguably embraced a presumption against cost-benefit analysis. This case, too, was decided before cost-benefit analysis became a feature of executive branch practice, and it was also before Chevron was decided as well. In this case, the act at issue required standards to protect worker health to the extent feasible. OSHA, the agency, had refused to consider cost-benefit analysis, and the court upheld that determination. And the court's reasoning in support of its holding suggest a presumption against the use of cost-benefit analysis in the absence of express statutory authority. The court observes, this is, quote, when Congress has intended that an agency engage in cost-benefit analysis, it has clearly indicated such intent on the face of the statute. Sounds pretty strong, doesn't it? Feasibility does not convey such an intent, and therefore cost-benefit analysis isn't required. That's the alternative approach. Justice Rehnquist had a different view of the meaning of feasibility and would have come to a different result. Cass Sunstein had nothing but disdain for the American Textile decision, saying that it made the Occupational Health and Safety Act, the statute involved in that case, irrational. Not surprising. So that brings us to Entergy Corporation, Entergy Corporation v. Riverkeeper, Inc., which was decided last spring. That case, I argue, indulged a presumption in the opposite direction. The decision addressed the question of whether EPA's use of cost-benefit analysis was permissible in setting standards under Section 316B of the Clean Water Act for cooling water intake structures for electric power plants. By a vote of 6-2-3, with Justice Breyer concurring in a separate opinion, the court upheld EPA's authority. Justice Stevens dissented with two justices joining him. And I want to spend some time here, a little time here, on the Scalia and Breyer opinions to show you how I think the presumption is working, and then we'll talk about, or I'll talk about, whether the presumption is warranted. Now, Justice Scalia and Justice Breyer have some priors, it's a nice rhyme, isn't it? Have some priors on this issue, which are probably important to lay out front. Both of them, this may be significant, both of them in their prior lives were administrative law professors. Whether that biases people in favor of some sort of cost-benefit analysis, I don't know, but they're certainly familiar with the issues here. And in extrajudicial writings, both of them have expressed a view that some form of cost-benefit analysis is essential for rational decision-making. Justice Breyer has the most complete record on this, and he's argued in different settings for cost-benefit analysis as a technique for weeding out regulatory controls that promise very small benefits in return for very high costs, what he calls the very high cost of achieving the last 10% of reductions of a pollutant or an environmental harm. Now, these extrajudicial views, I argue, prefigure what these justices do in the Entergy case. So the Clean Water Act, Section 316B, requires EPA to set standards for cooling water intake structures that reflect the best technology available for minimizing adverse environmental impacts. Keep that language in mind if you can. EPA interpreted that phrase in its rulemaking to allow it to weigh costs and benefits in establishing standards for these structures on existing power plants in order to avoid grossly disproportionate costs. Now the basic point of Section 316B is to protect aquatic life. These cooling water intake structures that are a subject of these standards are big, and they suck in just tons of water. They suck in the water through screens, which have the effect of impaling aquatic life that is pressed against them, and then aquatic life that gets through the screens is likely to be killed in the cooling water machinery itself. EPA estimated that the intake structures covered by the rule kill more than 3.4 billion fish and shellfish every year. Now, EPA tried to monetize, of course, first thing, monetize the benefits of not killing so many shellfish, but it couldn't really do it, because most of these fish and shellfish are little tiny things that aren't very important to people, so that only 2% of these fish and shellfish, less than 2%, could be monetized. EPA concluded that the most expensive option that saved the greatest percentage of fish was not warranted, and it selected a less protective level instead. So instead of requiring power plants to reduce deaths to fish by 95% across the range of plants under the most stringent option, the plants were required to reduce deaths within a range of 60 to 95% across the range of the facilities covered. This choice reduced the costs from $3.5 billion to something around $250 million. So the costs were reduced, as between these two options, by more than an order of magnitude. It's important that what the court understood the agency to be doing here was not a full-fledged cost-benefit analysis, but instead a rough balancing or comparison of costs and benefits with the fish considered in their natural units, that is, fish bodies, right? And with the purpose of weeding out an option which was determined to have disproportionate or unreasonable costs. Now, in his opinion upholding, Justice Scalia writes the opinion for the court, in his opinion upholding the agency's authority to proceed in this way, Justice Scalia faced an uphill battle with the statutory language. The statute requires the agency to adopt the best technology available for minimizing adverse environmental impact statement. The best technology available for minimizing adverse environmental impact, the phrase I gave you before. An ordinary person might read this language as requiring the agency to use the best technology available for minimizing adverse environmental impact. But we're lawyers, and we know that it doesn't always go that way. Justice Scalia uses Chevron and a creative textual analysis of these words to uphold the agency's use of cost-benefit analysis. The review of agency statutory interpretations under Chevron is traditionally framed as a two-step analysis. Step one, this is to be answered using the traditional tools of statutory analysis. Has Congress directly spoken to the issue? If yes, go no further. That interpretation is required. Step two, however, if not, is the agency's interpretation permissible? In Entergy, Scalia does a very unusual thing. He collapses these two steps into one step. And the one step is the agency's interpretation reasonable? And Scalia says, whoa, that's not a big deal. You say I'm doing one step where I should be doing two steps. But I'm not going to conclude that an agency's interpretation is reasonable if it's contrary to a determinate meaning of the statute that's apparent. So logically, his collapse of these two steps may make sense, but I think there's a subtle effect here. I think the subtle effect is to give Justice Scalia, or whoever judge is working in this way, more discretion in how to approach the statutory interpretation. It allows the court to either, one, deploy the traditional tools of statutory interpretation in a vigorous search for a definitive meaning, or two, instead, to use a more deferential examination of reasonableness or permissibility, the traditional step two analysis. And in Entergy, Justice Scalia chooses to proceed in the deferential step two mode. And he finds ample support in the language that I've quoted to you for the agency's interpretation. Best might mean, you know, the best technology for not killing the fish, but it doesn't necessarily mean that. Best might mean most efficient, right? And that's okay. It's not precluded by minimizing adverse environmental impact, because minimizing doesn't specify any level. Right. So he concludes that Section 316B does not unambiguously preclude cost-benefit analysis. This might not be the most obvious way of construing the statute, but it doesn't have to be, because Justice Scalia is proceeding here in deferential Step 2 mode. He also offers a similarly deferential analysis of Section 316B's statutory context supporting EPA's rule. I will spare you this. It involves a lot of best technology provisions, which Justice Scalia dutifully compares and then concludes allow the agency the room to do what it does. But importantly, mysteriously and importantly, and in my view, in a way that contradicts the rest of his analysis, Justice Scalia suggests that the statutory scheme would not support a rigorous form of cost-benefit analysis for Section 316B. In effect, he creates just enough room in the statute to accommodate the agency's non-rigorous reasonableness comparison, but arguably no more than that. And Justice Breyer's concurring opinion comes to a similar conclusion. Justice Breyer is not a textualist like Justice Scalia, so he doesn't get so hung up on the language of the statute. He buries himself instead in a piece of opaque legislative history, a statement by Senator Muskie on the floor about the statute, and draws from that legislative history the same conclusion. That is, EPA's approach is a reasonable interpretation of the statute. That is the approach that allows the agency to present and consider costs and benefits in non-monetized form, and use that comparison to avoid results that are absurd or unreasonable. To read the statute differently, Breyer concludes, would put the agency in conflict with a test of reasonableness by threatening to impose massive costs far in excess of any benefits. And I think you see the last 10% paradigm very close to the surface here in what Breyer is saying. Now, Breyer's analysis also includes some considerations against full cost-benefit, full-fledged cost-benefit analysis, right? So he sees this statutory arrangement as a compromise between concerns about cost-benefit analysis, that it crowds out non-economic values or minimizes their importance, that it may frustrate the development of new technologies, but he compares that to very strong reasons that come straight from him about the need to compare at some level costs and benefits in order to produce rational decision making. He says basically you can't have rational decision making without some consideration of costs and benefits. That would seem to compel a result that EPA is required to use cost-benefit analysis, but he stops short of that because he has these considerations on the other side. So my conclusion about Entergy is this. We see in both Justice Breyer's and Justice Scalia's opinions a modest pro-cost-benefit presumption doing work to expand the scope of agency discretion accorded under Chevron. And with this, I think, Entergy versus Riverkeeper takes a modest step toward reconciling the opposed practice of the administrative branch and the legislative branch, particularly the legislative branch as expressed in statutes enacted in the 1970s and 80s, of which the Clean Water Act is one. So this is a step away from the neutrality of TVA v. Hill. This is a step in the opposite direction from American textile, but I believe it is a defensible and desirable step. And there are three reasons why. It is defensible and desirable because it reflects a political consensus in favor of a weak form of cost-benefit analysis of the kind that the agency used here. Because it preserves the agency's choice to balance costs and benefits or not, and because it works within, arguably, a space that Congress has left to be filled by administrative agencies or the courts. Let me elaborate on those reasons just briefly. My first reason in support of this decision, this outcome, this is a political consensus justification. It's really the key to what I have to say here. Judicial presumptions have a number of possible justifications, but I think the presumption that is about agency authority to use cost-benefit analysis is probably most relevantly founded in a political consensus. That is, that the chief justification for such a presumption would be that it reflects the prevailing political preferences of the community. A shift in the presumption, as we see here, would be justified by a new political consensus. Now, this acknowledges a form of dynamic interpretation. Presumptions that address statutory ambiguities can change, and I'm arguing they have changed here. Is that a good idea? We might be concerned that this gives too much discretion to judges to shape statutory meaning to suit their own preferences. They just shift the presumption when they feel like it, right? But I think a justification for the change here can be framed that appropriately constrains judicial discretion and honors likely legislative preferences. The new presumption would only operate where the statute is ambiguous or arguably ambiguous. I put the word arguably in there because the presumption isn't doing any work if there isn't a larger or smaller boundary that can be established. And it would require the support of a demonstrable political consensus, not judicial whim, not something that a judge could just draw out of the air, but something very close, I think, to Einar L. Hauge's, he's a Harvard professor, electable political preference. He argues, convincingly, I think, that enacting legislatures would prefer a current preferences default rule of this sort, which makes present statutory interpretation of all ambiguous statutes correspond to their views, that is, the prevailing views of their generation, their cohort. What's the evidence that this is a, that this cost-benefit analysis is a current political preference, given this high standard? Well, you've got the practice of the executive branch, the interpretation that the court upheld in Section 316B was an interpretation of an executive branch agency. And you got the background practice of the executive branch using cost-benefit analysis since the 1980s. So this makes it more likely that the presumption reflects the current political culture and not merely the preferences of the majority of the justices currently on the court. But these actions and practices of the executive branch may not be sufficient to establish a political consensus to support the presumption. Controversy continues to swirl, as we've seen, around cost-benefit analysis. There's even dissension within the executive branch. Right now, in the Obama administration, Executive Order 12866 is being reviewed to see whether it needs to be changed. And then you have the mixed practice in Congress, which continues up to the present, as far as we can see. So in light of all this, I think it is important to the defensibility of the Entergy presumption that it be limited to a weak form of cost-benefit analysis. This form of cost-benefit analysis has broad intuitive appeal. It does not provoke the level of resistance that the strong form does, for reasons we've talked about. It is pluralist, allowing welfarist considerations to frame the debate, but not to decide it. And I think perhaps most importantly, it is based on a concept of rationality with links to the canon of avoidance of absurd results. This goes all the way back to Justice Powell's dissent in TVAVL. This canon, avoidance of absurd or irrational results, is universally accommodated by legislatures within the United States. And that's the final piece that gives legitimacy to this move by the Supreme Court. Now I'm going to move real quickly through my second and third reasons and then to a conclusion. The second reason for thinking this is a good thing is that it preserves the prerogatives of the executive branch. The agency can decide to do or not to do, and the executive branch is politically accountable. It's better to leave that choice to an agency. You might say, I mean, if the rationale behind the presumption is that not to consider costs and benefits would be irrational, you might say, well, why give the agency the discretion? But Breyer, in his concurring opinion, I think even Justice Scalia, is careful not to carry this logic too far. There may be valid reasons why Congress or an agency might forego cost-benefit analysis, even when the goal is efficiency, ultimately. Finally, congressional supremacy. I think although the analysis stretches the limits of the statutory language here, it doesn't violate those limits, and therefore it is consistent with, honors the supremacy of the legislature to define the boundaries of agency discretion. And I would argue further, but I'm not going to here because of considerations of time. I think to take the interpretation further, that is, the statute would have difficulty accommodating a reading that allowed formal cost-benefit analysis because of the ability of formal cost-benefit analysis to shift the bargain that I think Congress has struck. The weak form of cost-benefit analysis in this case, and I think a lot of other cases involving this kind of limitation, the weak form does not threaten, it merely cabins the decision by the agency. So my conclusion. The Entergy decision was by no means inevitable. I think the arguments on the other side were very strong. They could easily have won. What makes the difference, I think, or what made the difference, is the intuitive appeal of this weak form of cost-benefit analysis as a basic tool to distinguish rational from irrational decisions. But the opinion remains a somewhat awkward resting point in the evolution of judicial doctrine on cost-benefit analysis. There continue to be, as we've seen, strongly divisive elements, but there is also some forward progress in resolving those debates. Revez and others analyze the methodology and indicate how it can be changed for the better. Adler and Posner work on establishing a moral footing for cost-benefit analysis that allows other moral considerations to come into play. These efforts over time might relax the crucial objections of the critics of cost-benefit analysis. I'm hopeful. Such detente will likely depend on changes not only in theory and methodology, but also in practice and results, so it's going to take a little time. If achieved, I think, a new consensus on cost-benefit analysis would almost certainly be more eclectic, be more plural than is suggested by Cass Sunstein's, I think, unfortunate phrase, cost-benefit state. Right. But it would be a welcome basis for convergence of congressional and executive branch practice over time, with less need for the courts to navigate between. Thank you.